to avoid that fate. My name is Arnold Oliveira. This is a Small World Radio production.
Hi, this is David Amram. You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 on your FM dial, and keep on listening.
Good morning. You're tuned to 99.5 FM, WBAI in New York. City Watch came to you live over listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, WBAI in New York. Normally at 11 o'clock, you'd hear Radio Free Aaron with John McDonough and Malachi McCourt, but that is not on today. You'll be back next week. Instead, you'll hear a tribute to Bob Fass, the father of freeform radio and the legendary host of WBAI's Radio Unnameable, died peacefully in a hospital in North Carolina on Saturday afternoon, April 24th. This tribute will feature excerpts from some of Bob's programs, including guests from the 1960s, such as Bob Dylan, Arlo Guthrie, Muddy Waters, and Roger McGuinn of the Byrds. So please, stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives, and welcome to From the Vault, our weekly program that takes our history out of the vault and onto the radio. This week, we put our focus on one of the true legends of radio, the father of freeform radio, the voice of the cabal, Bob Fass.
Free. That's another commie word, like freedom. Free admission and dinner at, I'm not going to mention the names of these places, give them free publicity. That's a commie thing. This is America.
Prior to this program, the Pacifica Radio Archives held only a few examples of Fass's program, Radio Unnameable, in production since 1962. Today, we present new additions to the historic collection of the program that spoke to the people of New York City midnight to 6 a.m. five nights a week, and they spoke back.
This is WBAI, listener-sponsored radio in New York City. All over New York City, you know, right now, there are myriads of people doing their thing. At 2 o'clock in the morning, they're doing their thing, which is to clean up the effluvia of the daytime people, the people who work from 9 to 5, and come in the next morning and find everything clean, think the elves have done it. It's not true. It's the unsung heroes of New York City.
We are going to hear a few selections from the 1960s featuring Bob Dylan, Arlo Guthrie, and Roger McGuinn of the Byrds. Along with those marquee names, you will hear what we mean when we say freeform radio.
Free, the famous LP of the Lovin'. Free, a hippie love flower. Free, today only, take a trip. Free.
Paul Lovelace and Jessica Wolfson are film documentarians from New York City who have selected Bob Fass as the subject of their current project. They came to Los Angeles and the Pacifica Radio Archives as part of their research. We had a chance to talk to them about what inspired them about Bob.
We've begun the process of making a documentary film about WBAI disc jockey Bob Fass. And Bob Fass was one of the early pioneers for late night meaning from midnight till whenever, freeform FM radio at BAI in the early 1960s, which New York at that time was just a hub of the counterculture and all this new music and art and literature and protest. And, you know, everything around it was just so thrilling and so exciting. And he was in the midst of it. And he had all these people on his show, everyone from Bob Dylan to Allen Ginsberg to the Fugs to Dave Van Ronk to Abby Hoffman to Paul Krasner and so on and so on.
This is Bob Fass. We're back on here with Radio Unnameable. Remember I told you about 10 minutes ago that we were going to have somebody come up who wasn't Shirley Temple?
No, don't do this to me. We're fascinated by Bob and Bob's story. We've known about Bob for a while now because he's kind of this legendary figure on the airwaves.
That's why you never hear WBAI playing rock and roll, because that's part of the communist conspiracy. We don't play rock and roll on this station because that's your commie music.
If you're thinking of losing your mind, and I know you already have more. If I find your lost mind anywhere near my mind, I'm claiming if I almost have one.
Paul had made a documentary film about the Holy Modal Rounders, which is a New York psychedelic folk group. And the members of the Holy Modal Rounders had been on Bob's show back in the 60s. And even today, Peter Stanfill from the Holy Modal Rounders still goes on Bob's show all the time. So we had known about him through that, but when we read the New Yorker article, his story was so visual, and the history of his career was so amazing. Not only is, you know, his career, but it really told the story of the history of FM radio, the history of the counterculture movement, and we felt like it was a really interesting film to make.
Right, you know, as we've been discussing, Bob, and your action into the film documentary, you know, you're both rather young, I will say for the listeners. You know, and we've also talked about how many people don't know about WBAI in New York City and Bob Fass. So we think of New York City as being this great metropolitan city where everything hip is known by everybody. And Bob Fass is one of those secrets that New Yorkers and young people that just haven't had the education to know what they are, or the experience to live through those times when Bob is there all the time, every night, 12 to 6 a.m. We were also talking about Bob Fass being the voice of the night. As you were talking about being visual, it is sort of like that, the dark, wet streets and the lights, and the city's different at night. And those people that work or are alive and awake during the nighttime are very different than the day people, and they sort of never cross over. So a lot of day people don't know who Bob Fass is, but if we talk to people who live in the night, over those years, they probably know him better than the day people.
And then there's the day people who stay up all night listening to Bob and have to go to work and are really tired, too.
Right. Who are addicted to Bob's show.
To Bob's show. I mean, for example, there's one listener who talks about in the 70s growing up on Staten Island and, you know, just staying up all night. She was a teenager, staying up all night and hearing about him protesting the war and hearing all this music and nothing that anyone in her family, anyone of her peers at school had ever exposed her to. And this person is actually Bob's wife now. But
I knew that story was coming to that today. And I was like, that sounds familiar.
Right.
There's a lot of listeners like that. I mean, people who have these very specific stories of when they first heard Bob. I mean, there's this one guy who just remembers he was doing some all-night security detail at some hospital or something like that, and he turned on the radio one night and he hears Sergeant Pepper's. He's like, oh, great. Then he hears the next song, and then he hears the next song. Then he hears the needle, the record flip over, and then he hears the next song. He's like, wow, he's playing the entire album. And then the album ends, and then there's a pause, and he starts playing the entire album again. And so it just... taking chances like that, it's completely free.
And I think that's the point of the historical aspect of Bob and what he's contributed to the medium of radio and broadcasting really as an invention and a continuing experiment. As you know, that free form, it's still not formed after 50-some years. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, we're still in that experimental stage, which is still innovative.
Right.
You know, even in today when we think all the creative ways to put something on the radio has already been done. It's still being sort of massaged with Bob. I think about a month ago, I was on Bob's show for the first time, and he came maybe 40 minutes late. So I was on the air with, I don't know, an engineer or something, but he was stuck on the bridge. So he couldn't get through traffic, so he finally came on. But, you know, that was just the way it is. That's New York City for you.
Right. People we've spoke to about Bob, they talked about him as almost like a jazz musician, you know, and playing the beat and, you know, going from one flow to the other. And it's a total improv, freeform thing. But, you know, who could do that? I mean, it takes a real true artist to be able to think 5 steps ahead, and even if that's subconsciously, and you know, just pulling random CDs. He has a bag of CDs that he brings with him every time, and videotapes, and you know, records, and books that he'll read from, and callers that he, and it's just pulling things and putting it on the air and changing it and overlapping, and it's this amazing.
Can we just play a record in the meantime and go in there and just
yeah, any records you want to hear?
Oh yeah, I want to hear that Lightning Hopkins record.
I got a black cat bone. I got a mojo too. I got the Johnny Conqueror. I'm gonna mess with you.
In a compressed example of what freeform radio is, this next sequence taken from a 1976 air check, Bob Fass goes from taking a phone call about the unrest in Ireland to singer-songwriter and the guitarist of the Byrds, Roger McGuinn, jumping in about his near-miss from a bombing at LaGuardia Airport, then to a live music performance. This is a good example of freeform radio.
You're on the air.
I want to talk about Northern Ireland again.
Go ahead.
Okay. In 1921... there was still the Civil War going, the Black and Tan War. And the Black and Tans, they were called that way because these guys were taken right out of British jails. Some British film board, I think it was, suppressed a film about this guy named Michael Collins, who was an intelligent in charge of the intelligence of the IRA at the time. And he knocked off a whole bunch of British spies and dudes like that. He was pretty, you know, he was embarrassing. He really made them look bad.
The Laughing Boy, they called him. Right?
Truth, I'm not all that hip on Irish history to know that.
Michael Collins.
Well,
right?
This guy from Wales made a movie about it, like a documentary to be shown on British TV or any TV, and they suppressed it.
I know a little bit about some of this because I was an actor, and I was in an off-Broadway show called The Hostage by Brendan Behan, and...
I don't know a whole lot about him either.
Oh, you should read Behan. You'd love him. You'd love him. You'd love him. He's so human and so warm and so crazy and so funny.
All right.
And he's beautiful. Just beautiful. Brendan Behan, The Hostage, was a great play about somebody who's on the verge of being executed in Glasshouse in Dublin. Mountjoy Prison, Mountjoy Prison in Dublin.
And they still got IRA guys in there.
And The Hostage is about a young British Army soldier is kidnapped by the IRA, and he's held in a whorehouse because, you know, that's the underground cover, and it's a great, great play. The bells of hell go ring-a-ling-a-ling for you, but not for me. Oh, death, where is thy sting-a-ling-a-ling? And the whole cast comes out, and they do a vaudeville turn, and it's just, like, great.
Well, you know, they got a play now with the, it's the Irish Arts Center. It's on 51st Street on the west side. It's called The Flats, and it's about Belfast and about a house on a corner where they have those riots. And they got a British soldier in there, too. There was an accident, like, on the road, it was in the middle of the town. And when the guy jumped out, he had left one of these guns in the car, and he left his identification, and he had the names of several Republicans, IRA people, and Sinn Féin people in the neighborhood, you know, who had been let out of prison or something. And he was going to go around knocking them off, you know, because he'd been keeping records of their data, and he had 2 weapons in the car, like automatic weapons, and he split out. You know, he got away. But by their, you know, the IDs and the stuff he left in the car, they figured he was a British agent. And they've been doing this, and there's British agents in New York City right now.
I came in through LaGuardia the night before last, and I was looking at the gray dust on the walls and the bowed out windows and doors.
Sick.
Yeah, crazy.
That was more than crazy. That was sick, man.
I know. Well, yeah, it was strange, you know.
I mean, it's no propaganda or nothing.
I know. Nobody claimed it, right?
You think it might have been some kind of an accident? That was something that was bound for someplace else.
I would say it was for the place. They said it blew a 10 by 15 foot hole in a reinforced concrete ceiling.
They said it was a professional job. It didn't look like the kind of stuff that people got off a construction site or anything like that. It was.
Yeah, but isn't it possible that it was a package that was being, say, taken to Angola?
No, they found two other bombs in the same terminal area.
Really?
Were they planted or were they?
Did they find two other bombs?
That's what I heard.
Were they planted or were they just in other suitcases?
Oh, they were in suitcases, yeah.
Ah, so it still could have been like it was bound for someplace else, for some CIA
That's
toolkit,
possible, but I'm not sure. I shouldn't be saying this, because I'm not positive about the details.
Roger McGuinn is here. That's Roger McGuinn.
I came in from, I was up skiing in Minnesota, and believe it or not, they've got some skiing over there.
Weren't you in Vail, Colorado, in the president's party?
That's a 10-4 there, guy, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, the CIA invited me over for, a brief skiing, little vacation, a little Christmas holiday vacation out there. No, I didn't go to Vail. The company, didn't support me. But, I went to Minnesota, and I came back on North Central Airlines, not to plug anybody, but and the terminal I landed in was LaGuardia, which was between the TWA and Delta thing, and I had to walk down through the baggage claim area to get out of the airport, and there was all this gray powder around. It smelled like dynamite inside.
I was in the LaGuardia, and I went into a bookshop. And the book clerk was talking about what it was like at the moment of the impact and how the smoke filled the place. It must have been a...
I wasn't there for the blast, but I was there for the aftermath.
Glad you missed it, man.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
I missed it by about 72 hours, but some friends of mine missed it by about 25 minutes.
What kind of motions are you making out there that are distracting you?
I've seen
you
motions
so
to those women.
Listen, women are in total control of tonight.
Right, I see.
Right on. Oh, sister.
When I come into your
studio.
Were six or eight women moved in advance of you guys.
Lee and Muffy.
Put all of the microphones
Robin,
together.
Robin is with us.
St. Robin? Who's St. Robin?
Forget about Slocum and McGuinn.
Right. Well,
forget about women. That's what we say. Forget about them.
They're out there setting up. I mean, women are the engineers of the world.
Right.
So let's get it on.
La 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 la.
We have something to say about Leonard Crowdog. He's a Sioux Indian.
Leonard Crowdog is the Hurricane Carter of the Sioux Indian tribe.
Since Hurricane...
Worse than Hurricane Carter.
It'd be better if you talked into a microphone.
Yeah,
especially when you're saying such good things.
My sisters, I love you.
You were...
Lola gets a little effusive sometimes.
You're listening to the lunatic fringe of the feminist movement.
We are the feminist movement.
Yeah, the lunatic fringe.
When I was a little girl, I wished I was a boy. I tagged along behind the gang.
One of the things, as we were talking about how he invented freeform radio, that really doesn't hit in terms of a specific for today's people. But if we can sort of think about old-time radio where everything's scripted and there's a live audience and you see, Judy Garland say something and Lana Turner says something else and there's Bob Hope as the host sponsored by Ovaltine or stuff like that, that's how radio was for the American people. But then Bob came in and this sort of idea of public radio and Pacifica Radio and WBI meant that there were no sponsors, there was nobody to live up to other than the listeners. So the idea of opening up the airwaves and letting people call in and just dialogue, just talk at your own pace, say what you want, nothing is edited, nothing's censored, nothing's mediated, except by Bob's subconscious, if you will. That was an absolutely mind-blowing thing for people who had been trained that you're waiting for the commercial, you're waiting for the script, you're waiting for the announcer, the narrator, and the introduction.
Right.
And this is sort of where it never fits that form. So that's what's so mind-blowing about Bob, for me anyway.
Yeah, and And there's examples of where something like that can lead. I mean, he was extremely active. I mean, the Yippies, the Youth International Party, were announced on his program, and he was an early Yippie. And, you know, when they started doing all these be-ins and these very innovative protests in and around New York City, he would use that, the call-ins and the callers, you know, when there was a riot at Grand Central Station. And
this was 1969, right?
1967, I believe. I could be wrong there.
But in that period, smack dab.
Directly before Chicago. And
it led up to the riots that were happening in Grand Central were, you know, a window of what was going to happen in Chicago because the police were getting more active.
Late 67 into 68.
But callers, but his show, I mean, it was this exciting thing. It was after the BN in Central Park, you know, the first hour of the show, he's playing songs about trains and, you know, it's like a very happy, you know, it's all about love. And then, you know, things went awry and then protesters were getting arrested and beaten by the police, and he had people call in, and then it turned into this, you know, kids calling in, like, you know, a cop hit me over the head, what do I do? And Bob's putting them in touch with the ACLU, whoever it might be. He's just having people, witnesses who are there, talk about what they experienced. I mean, it's live radio in the most intense way. I mean, I listened to it 40 years later, and it's very powerful, and right. He's in the trenches.
We have someone here who saw some. Let me tell you this before we go any further, that there was something on the tape that said that the people who were arrested are being taken to the 17th precinct. That's about the only information that we have so far about where the people who have been arrested are being taken. So I'm trying very hard to find out where they are, and we have someone who called up before and said that they were in the police station in Grand Central Station. And that there was someone who was injured, and that they couldn't get medical assistance for this person because they couldn't find the officer that made the arrest. I don't understand that. That they had been waiting for nearly an hour since this man had been injured. Hello, where are you now?
Oh no, I was at Grand Central Station before.
Oh no, I was at Grand Central Station.
Yeah, do you want to tell us anything about what happened?
Yes. I was over there.
Yeah.
And I was dressed. Natural. And these cops up there were pushing me around, and I was just coming out from eating a frankfurter. And I wasn't even doing nothing.
What do you mean by natural?
You know, I was dressing, you know, regular clothes, collegiate. And
where do you go to school?
Me? I don't go to school.
You were just dressed in collegiate style.
Uh-huh.
Maybe they got you for impersonating a student.
Nah, I wasn't dressed like, you know, the hippies.
Uh-huh. What were you doing there?
Nah, you know, me and my friend, we just went down there because, you know, they said that there was, you know, this big thing going on down there. And,
Hello?
I'm on this line.
Oh.
Okay, can you tell me what happened?
You know, we just, you know, got off the train and we went upstairs. Everything was going nice. At the beginning, there wasn't no trouble.
Yeah?
But then after a while, that's when everything started.
What kind of trouble was that?
You know, the cops started pushing everybody and chasing them all the way to the back. You know, and everybody was knocking down each other. And then, you know, when I was coming out from the needle stand, the cop up there, you know, pushed me with the stick.
Yeah.
And my friend, too.
Had you done anything?
I didn't do nothing. I was just walking to catch the train to come home.
Could you see any reason why people were being pushed around?
I didn't see no reason at all, because they weren't bothering nobody.
Okay, if you hear about this thing ever coming to trial, I hope you'll come forward and say what you saw.
Okay. I would like to know if you play any records.
Over there in South Vietnam, our boys are fighting rain. Some mother dear is praying for the Lord our country to save. The boys
right, and I think that, you know, in terms of the medium, you know, we're isolating the audio So, you know, we don't have a visual or a smell or a taste or everything of what people are listening. So sometimes the creativity and the expansion of the imagination is very open when you isolate into one sense. So that's sort of his masterwork of his taking one sense and then creating an imagination, an explosion of power. When I heard the word witness, which I think is very important in terms of what is the power to the listener? Now, we're in 1969 when there is no access to that information. The people who are homebound, I always think visually if there's a homebound man or woman who has no way to get out and participate in society, has no way to fulfill or express themselves in the protest, mm-hmm. in the people that are down on the ground in the 60s, you know, putting their life on the line, as the student protesters at the Columbia student strike said. You know, when they did that, they made a choice. They might have been arrested for resisting the draft, and they might be expelled from the college, and they might go to jail, which means their entire life would be upturned. And there, so your life, everything was right on the line. So if you think about the homebound people that had no physical way or even emotional, mental way to participate, Bob's program and WBAI was that way that people could experience and feel they participated, even if it is in the emotional sense of, oh my gosh, you just got hit over the head. What's going to happen next? What's the anticipation of this event? And I think that that's where it bears witness to what happens, even in the sense that the listeners become participatory, even in the energetic metaphysic state, like their brains are working in the aspect of I'm participating in this action. So somehow when the knowledge of the protests, if you watched NBC, ABC, CBS, you weren't going to get any of that. You may get a small report of the yippies and the hippies that just got beaten up, right. But you're not going to get the experience. I just spoke right. for a very long time.
That's
really spot on.
That's true. And it's, he kind of takes this cue himself from Gene Shepherd and, you know, wondering who's out there, how many people are out there listening. And, a famous example of that is the film Network. And they, you know, I'm not going to take it anymore. And they, you know, the people yell, stick their heads out the window. So, which was based on something that Gene Shepherd did. And, you know, and Bob, after midnight, there's no ratings. You don't know how many people are out there. You don't know who's listening. But before all this, before Grand Central, before the BN, he wanted to know himself. He referred to his listeners as the Cabal, which, you know, roughly means, you know, people meeting in secret at night on horseback or something like that. And he just felt it was a good term to describe the night people. So he just said, let's have a party. Let's go out to JFK in one of the airport hangars and see how many people we could get. And thousands of people showed up.
Wow.
And
what year was that?
That was 66. It was the beginning of the Central Park BN and everything. It was called. He called it the fly-in.
Wow.
And he just talked about it on air every night for 2 weeks and said, on this day, we're all going to go to JFK. And he didn't have any idea how many people were going to show. And it was amazing. I mean, there are photographs of that. It's just a sea of people hanging out and partying, you know, in an airport.
So. Wow, don't you wish you could have been there?
Yeah.
Sure.
It must have been a really good party.
But I think it's a really important to talk about also that, you know, all of this happened in the 60s, and that was amazing. But Bob's still on the air today, and he's been on the air for 40 years. So, you know, he continued doing all of these things, even though the counterculture movement had kind of stepped aside and, you know, the people weren't protesting anymore after Vietnam. He was still finding those causes and he was still bringing those people together. And, you know, his show is every Thursday night. He still has the group of listeners.
Right. You know, when I think of Bob as experimentation, I also think of him as a Renaissance man of wanting to know about everything, the curiosity about, you know, authors and filmmakers and musicians and political activists and how it all weaves together. And it's sort of that freedom of expression of however you tell your story to me is the way we're going to talk today. However you express yourself through music or political action is how we're going to talk today. And I think that is definitely the fulfillment of the mission of Pacifica by creating dialogue between peoples to have a better understanding of each other. In that creative expression, you know, I always think of journalists and poets mm-hmm. trying to tell the story of society, and that's sort of the dream of Pacifica. But Bob has somehow found that niche, I never can figure out what the pronunciation is on that, his own little special way to bring all that together. And again, it has never really been documented. And I think now we're going to talk about, you know, what we're here to sort of call out to.
Right.
Which is, you know, now that we know about Bob Fass's history and his influence on not only media broadcastings, but individuals, like great giants in whatever field they are in poets writing, you know, they really turned to Bob as a great influence, whether it was as a listener or as an interviewee. So now we know, you know, myself as the Pacifica archivist and you as, you know, young people who have found, you know, this great thing that nobody knows about, and you want, you in your own creative expression want to be able to expose that. But now we have both, all three of us have come together and other people around us to know that, you know, all those master reel-to-reel tapes of all these great recordings have never been preserved. They have never been taken hand by hand and put onto a player so that we can transfer them, and they're in real danger of disappearing. They're in absolute critical danger, in the emergency state, as the archives would assess it. And we finally have come together to try to create a cabal, if you will, to go and do, and rescue those tapes so that we can make these materials and this great history, you know, available for researchers and scholars and listeners of, and make them accessible so they can be heard. This is From the Vault. For more information about this program, go to fromthevaultradio.org or call us at the archives 1-800-735-0230.
My mind capsized, I'm hanging to the hole. No, no, wait a minute, that's just my skull. There's a jackhammer in the machine, baby, ripping up my brain. It feels like a flood of torrential rain. Torrential rain. Afraid the rainbow has just turned brown. I do believe I am coming down. My favorite rainbow has just turned brown. I believe I am coming down, coming down, coming down.
So tell me a little bit about how, what you found and what your dream is.
Well, you know, those,
which I'm all for. I'm right in the middle of the dream.
we are the dream. Right, right.
Those tapes that you're referring to currently live in Bob's house.
And on Staten Island.
On Staten Island.
Where the climate isn't that great.
Where the climate is not great. Where he does not have the resources to preserve them. I mean, he wants more than anything to preserve the his history. Because it's not his only his history. It's his peers' history, his friends' history, his community's history. And he just doesn't have the resources. So he, you know, he's in a holding pattern right now. And one of the things that we want to do is not only to document his life, but to, you know, help him, you know, find a home, a better home and a better place for this material, which is invaluable.
Right. So, you know, one of the problems we have with the Pacifica Archives is we don't have the resources to, you know, direct to that project. Although, and we're, you know, we certainly have been talking with Bob and doing the most we can with our resources to help. But I think we've come to the conclusion altogether, everybody who's seen those tapes, that it's time for a rescue mission. So this is sort of a national call. If you're interested in helping in any way you can to preserve the materials and the history of WBAI, Bob Fass, and all those guests that were on, we have literally maybe a dozen tapes that exist in the Pacifica archives that are formally preserved of Bob's recordings. There are thousands of others that are waiting to be preserved and made available, not only for the use for your documentary and other films like the Chicago 10 that's recently out, but for future programs that we could
sure.
do, not only on Pacifica Radio, but make them useful for scholars. So, because how important it is to you, the listener, that the historians who write the books of history of the 20th century, when they write the history of the counterculture movement, how critical is it for those materials to be part of the story? Do you want someone to only look at NBC footage and New York Times pieces to tell the story? Or do you want someone like Bob's way of bringing the night voices into tape to be part of the history once, you know, in 100 years when we're all, you know, past this earthly pain, what is it that we leave as a legacy? So this is what we're talking about. How do we save Bob Fass's legacy, which is our own legacy? You know, we're all participant in Bob's experiment as well.
Right.
So if you're interested, call the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or log on to our website at pacificaradioarchives.org. We look at the WBAI station folio program guides, which is what you're actually here in the archives doing your deep research, deep archival research of looking at photographs and articles and mentions of the Radio Unnamable, which is Bob's name of his program.
Well, one of the things is when you look at the folios, you go down the list and it has, you know, the 6 o'clock program, you know, Sonny Rollins in the studio, the 8 o'clock program, Allen Ginsberg in the studio. Anytime Bob shows listed, there's just the name of the show, Radio Unnamable, because he doesn't know who's going to drop in. So some of the things that happened over the years, one of Bob Dylan's very, very first radio appearances was on his program, and they basically just did comedy. And then he also had Bob Dylan coming by other times after that playing music, and you know, Jerry Jeff Walker, for the very first time in public on live radio, performed Mr. Bojangles. The very first version of Alice's Restaurant was performed on Bob's show.
Right.
He was in the trenches in Chicago at the Democratic Convention in 68, walking around the streets during the protests, like getting hit, you know, sprayed with tear gas while recording reactions from people, you know, in the war zone. And you know, all of that's in the archive.
You know, during the Chicago 7 trial, Abbie Hoffman called Radio Unnamable every night to report what was going on in the trial. That's amazing.
And then when Abbie Hoffman was in hiding, too, after he got arrested in the early 70s, and Bob's show was kind of his lifeline to the rest of the world. I mean, very few people knew where he was, and Bob was one of them, and he called into the program. And but then there's just all these, you know, people who are either starting out or happen to be in town that might stop by. You know, everyone from Muddy Waters and Allen Ginsberg and Patti Smith. And
you know what this reminds me of is the Algonquin Roundtable. You know, if you think about the best minds or the best creative minds in the world that came to the Waldorf Astoria and sat around a table and chatted about the world, this is sort of like the 20th century version of that.
Right.
Or at least the late last half of the 20th century version of that, that Bob is the center of the table and all these great minds sort of came there to chat it up.
Right.
To talk about the world. It may not be about their thing.
It was the place to go. It was, you know, after the clubs closed or after the band, you know, the bands played, where did you go? Oh, let's go over to WBAI. Let's go hang out and see what's happening over there. And so people would just come in. There would be a flow. It was an open door. So, you know, you never knew who was going to show up that night and how many people in the studio were. And, you know, there's, I'm sure, amazing recordings of people who jamming together who never would be in the same room to do things.
In 1968, Bob Fass invited legendary bluesman Muddy Waters and his longtime pianist Otis Spann to the WBAI studios for an evening of live music and conversation. In this sequence, Muddy Waters and Spann try to define the elusive meaning of the blues.
Down. The blue put me on my feet again. When I was sick and down, Lord, the blue put me on my feet again. You where I've been. Well, I went well down in the bottom. That's where the blues came on. Well, I went well down in the bottom.
Some people don't know what the blues is, but the blues is the blues. And the blues don't know nobody, no way.
You mean the blues don't love nobody?
They don't love nobody either.
I witnessed that.
That's the truth.
But they help. They help.
The blues will help anybody. If you listen to them. But they really don't like nobody. So a lot of people hate the blues. But you can't hate the blues no better than they hate you. That's true. That is true. The blues were born all by itself. The blues were born on a... I said... It's
on a hate
just side. Like a gravity. It's it was born on a hate, you're right. It's, the blues just come up from...
Well, I don't hate the blues, I love them.
I love the blues also, but when you got the blues, the blues
I like to blues, I like to tell it. People my troubles.
That's right.
And let everybody know that
right.
I feel in my heart that I need help.
Well, the blues help.
And the blues will help me.
The blues sure help you. Believe me when I say.
In 1966, Ramblin' Jack Elliott and Arlo Guthrie made their way to the WBAI studios during one of the earliest marathon fundraisers to help encourage listeners to send in their donations. Ramblin' Jack begins by playing an old truck driver tune.
This is WBAI in New York City.
Just stop by to have a cup of coffee now. Don't give me no whiskey. Ain't got time for wine. Got a wheel that's old semi down the line. Here, about 40 miles down the road. My trailer's empty. Sure can bounce. About to shake, my kidney is loose. And it's getting dark. And I'm getting bleary-eyed.
That's Jack Elliott.
Just thought I'd drive around. Give you a little sound. Just stop by to have a cup of coffee now. Just black,
No, sure, man.
Please.
Thank you.
It's kind of hot. Needs a little something to cool it down there.
You're gonna put it in the coffee?
All right. That's all right. Don't give me no biscuit. Ain't got time for wine. Gotta wheel this old semi down the line.
There you go.
You know, the only real disagreement that I ever had with you, I think, and you didn't even know about it, was when I went and I listened to the Johnny Cash version of the song after I heard your version of the song. Yours cuts his to ribbons, shreds.
Well, mine is based on his, but then his was based on my original one anyway. I like his because he put me in there. He says, oh, hello there, Jack, or something like that. I always like to listen to that record of Johnny Cash saying, hello, Jack.
The son of folk hero Woody Guthrie, Arlo Guthrie, then jumps on the piano and debuts his now classic song, Alice's Restaurant, before he even had a record contract.
The song. That's why I call the song Alice's Restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. Walk right in. Just a half a mile from the railroad track, and you can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. Now the story I'm gonna tell you right now is called Alice's Restaurant. Multicolored rainbow roach, spy tingler. It was all started one day. It all started that great day when Max, a Russian scientist, went up to visit Alice at the restaurant, sitting down drinking a cup of coffee. And there, on the wall, straight ahead, was a perfect example of the multicolored rainbow roach. And Max immediately put it in his pocket, ran out of the restaurant without paying for the coffee, and went back to New York City, smuggled the roach back to Russia, back in Moscow. Five of Russia's leading scientists studied the multicolored rainbow roach for use in possible atomic warfare. It was about the same time that Sam, a Chinese scientist, was up at Alice's restaurant eating a cheeseburger with French fries. And there on the wall, was a multicolored rainbow roach equaled never before in the history of the world.
Red, white,
Sam immediately put the roach into his pocket, went back to New York City, and smuggled the roach back into China. In Peking, five of China's leading scientists studied the multicolored rainbow roach for use in possible atomic warfare.
Back at the White House, Lyndon was getting very upset at the disappearing multicolored rainbow roaches from Alice's restaurant. An investigating team was immediately sent up to Alice's restaurant. And there, friends, there on the wall was two perfect examples of the multicolored rainbow roach. The roaches were immediately snatched, went out, back to the White House, where they were studied for possible use in defense.
They were to be used.
It was about this time that Max, the Russian scientist, was seen again at the scene of Alice's restaurant, where Max was looking for more multicolored rainbow roaches to bring back to Moscow. He looked around under the tables and all kinds of things, and there in the salt shaker was four multicolored rainbow roaches. They were immediately pocketed and brought back to Moscow, where, as you all know, there was one roach for every of the scientists that was studying for use in possible atomic warfare. Meanwhile, Sam, the Chinese scientist, was back at Alice's restaurant eating another cheeseburger with French fries. And there in the pepper shaker was four beautiful examples of the multicolored rainbow roach. That's a pepper.
But I like it.
They were brought back to Peking, and China's five leading scientists studied the multicolored rainbow roaches, one each. They studied intensely.
Rainbow roaches.
Lyndon was getting very disturbed because it was a grand total of 10 missing rainbow roaches from Alice's restaurant. Alice was getting worried. So was Lyndon, and a team was sent up to Alice's restaurant to study and to try to find more multicolored rainbow roaches. And when they walked in, when they walked in, there on the wall was the biggest, the most gigantic, multicolored rainbow roach ever to be seen in the history of the world. It was a 4x5 foot multicolored rainbow roach.
Look at it!
And that was a roach. A 4x5 foot roach. And you know what a joint that must have been. It was immediately brought back to the White House in a truck in a capsule, where it was put on the table of the Defense Department's plan. And while the Defense Department stood around and studied the multicolored rainbow roach, the biggest one in the history of the world, McNamara spilled his tea on the multicolored rainbow roach on the corner of the roach and immediately wiped it up with his napkin, which immediately went to his lips to wipe up the lips on his napkin, and he tasted the multicolored rainbow roach on the edge of the napkin. McNamara licked his finger and then licked the roach. Put the finger back in his mouth, licked his finger and licked the roach. Put the finger back in his mouth, licked the roach and licked his finger. He kept doing it. The others joined. It was a half hour later.
What are you looking
But I like you.
The White House was stoned. They were sitting around taking licks. They were copping licks off of the 4x5 multicolored rainbow roach. And it was this time that a defense plan had to be set up. The defense plan was called into her. Everybody came there, and it was the biggest defense plan ever devised by the United States. Friends, unknown to the American people, a big blanket was being made in Washington. On the top of the blanket was a picture of the United States. Unfortunately, the blanket was as big as the United States. And on the top was a picture of the United States. And on the bottom was a picture of the sky.
Statue of Liberty.
When placed into position, those people under the thing thought it was the sky. And those people over the thing thought that it was the earth. And nobody was quite sure which was which or if the thing was actually in place. The biggest blanket ever to hit the United States. It was one day that the Russians were testing out a new plan. Yes, friends, Scotch taped the roach to the missile nose. A test was made. One day a missile went screaming toward the heavens. It went up and came down and exploded in the air. And after the song, we can all go home tonight and have our own third world wars, as it would seem. Yes, friends, if you can't wait for the third world war, go home and start your own. Prepare your children, your dogs, your cats, your mothers and fathers, and all kinds of groovy people that may want to know about it. Don't be uptight.
Scowl.
This could be the chance of your life. The third world war, and when it comes, we'll all be out there snuffing the air. The third world war air. And we'll be singing. You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant. I said, walk right in. It's around the back. Just a half a mile from the railroad track. And you can get anything you want.
The thing about Bob, and I think this is similar to a lot of people of his generation and maybe just similar to people in general, is that Bob's a pack rat. He doesn't like throwing things out. He wants to keep everything. And for an archivist, that's, you know, a dream. It's a golden, wonderful egg to have. You don't like people who throw things out every, you know. But as a person living in a small house with minimal funds to put those things somewhere where it's not in their daily life, it's very difficult for him. So unfortunately, he and his wife live amongst this history. And because it's in their daily routine, they're not taking care of it properly the way they need to do. They need, you know, to get from one end of the house to the other, they need to move 500 reels. And to, you know, they're not thinking the long term. They're thinking, I need to go to the bathroom. I need to go to the kitchen. And so it's just, it's a matter of, you know, one, trying to preserve these things, but two, trying to give them a living environment.
You know, I think our listeners, at least some of them, might understand what that process is. If you think about it, your grandmother's garage that hadn't been taken care of, the old attic that hasn't been taken care of, and you just don't think about it, and, you know, 40 years go by, and you're looking for the photograph that it's now brown or yellow. And that's what we're talking about. These are absolutely you know, carbon-based materials that do deteriorate much faster than we think, and the tapes are not being held and preserved properly or boxed properly. And so we have sort of a dream to rescue those tapes.
You have been listening to Bob Fass and his Radio Unnameable program on From the Vault, the Pacifica Radio Archives program that takes our history out of the vault and onto the radio. We'd like to thank Paul Lovelace and Jessica Wolfson for their efforts to save the Radio Unnameable recordings, and special thanks to Lynn Fass and Bob Fass. For more information or for a copy of this program, call us at 1-800-735-0230 or visit fromthevaultradio.org. From the Vault was written and produced by Brian DeShazer and Mark Torres, and executive produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives and Brian DeShazer. From the Vault is presented as part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, which is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts and grants from the Grammy Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the University of California Berkeley's Moffitt Library, the Pacifica Foundation, and from contributions from Pacifica station listeners. Our theme music is by Kevin Drum Holiday. Thanks for listening. Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives, and welcome to From the Vault, our weekly program that takes our history out of the vault and onto the radio. This week, we put our focus on one of the true legends of radio, the father of freeform radio, the voice of the cabal, Bob Fass.
Free. That's another commie word, like freedom. Free admission and dinner at, I'm not going to mention the names of these places, give them free publicity. That's a commie thing. This is America.
Prior to this program, the Pacifica Radio Archives held only a few examples of Fass's program, Radio Unnameable, in production since 1962. Today, we present new additions to the historic collection of the program that spoke to the people of New York City midnight to 6 a.m. five nights a week, and they spoke back.
This is WBAI, listener-sponsored radio in New York City. All over New York City, you know, right now, there are myriads of people doing their thing. At 2 o'clock in the morning, they're doing their thing, which is to clean up the effluvia of the daytime people. The people who work from 9 to 5 and come in the next morning and find everything clean, think the elves have done it. It's not true. It's the unsung heroes of New York City.
We are going to hear a few selections from the 1960s featuring Bob Dylan, Arlo Guthrie, and Roger McGuinn of the Byrds. Along with those marquee names, you will hear what we mean when we say free-form radio.
Free, the famous LP of the lovin'. Free, a hippie love flower. Free, today only, take a trip. Free.
Paul Lovelace and Jessica Wolfson are film documentarians from New York City who have selected Bob Fass as the subject of their current project. They came to Los Angeles and the Pacifica Radio Archives as part of their research. We had a chance to talk to them about what inspired them about Bob.
We've begun the process of making a documentary film about WBAI disc jockey Bob Fass. And Bob Fass was one of the early pioneers for late night meaning from midnight till whenever, freeform FM radio at BAI in the early 1960s, which New York at that time was just a hub of the counterculture and all this new music and art and literature and protest, and, you know, everything around it was just so thrilling and so exciting, and he was in the midst of it. And he had all these people on his show, everyone from Bob Dylan to Allen Ginsberg to the Fugs to Dave Van Ronk to Abby Hoffman to Paul Krasner and so on and so on.
This is Bob Fass. We're back on here with Radio Unnameable. Remember I told you about 10 minutes ago that we were going to have somebody come up who wasn't Shirley Temple?
No, come on. Now, don't do this to me.
I'm sorry, what am I doing? I'm going to apologize.
You want me to introduce you like Mike Wallace?
No, I want to be.
This is Bob Dylan.
I can't say who it is.
Oh, all right.
We're fascinated by Bob and Bob's story. We've known about Bob for a while now because he's kind of this legendary figure on the airwaves.
That's why you never hear WBAI playing rock and roll, because that's part of the communist conspiracy. We don't play rock and roll on this station because that's your commie music.
If you're thinking of losing your mind, and I know you already have more, if I find your lost mind anywhere near my mind, I'm claiming if I almost have one, claiming that I already have the.
Paul had made a documentary film about the Holy Modal Rounders, which is a New York psychedelic folk group. And the members of the Holy Modal Rounders had been on Bob's show back in the 60s. And even today, Peter Stanfill from the Holy Modal Rounders still goes on Bob's show all the time. So we had known about him through that, but when we read the New Yorker article, his story was so visual, and the history of his career was so amazing. Not only is, you know, his career, but it really told the story of the history of FM radio, the history of the counterculture movement, and we felt like it was a really interesting film to make.
Right, you know, as we've been discussing, Bob, and your action into the film documentary, you know, you're both rather young, I will say for the listeners. you know, and we've also talked about how many people don't know about WBAI in New York City and Bob Fass. So we think of New York City as being this great metropolitan city where everything hip is known by everybody. And Bob Fass is one of those secrets that New Yorkers and young people that just haven't had the education to know what they are, or the experience to live through those times when Bob is there all the time, every night, 12 to 6 a.m. We were also talking about Bob Fass being the voice of the night. As you were talking about being visual, it is sort of like that, the dark, wet streets and the lights, and the city's different at night. And those people that work or are alive and awake during the nighttime are very different than the day people, and they sort of never cross over. So a lot of day people don't know who Bob Fass is, but if we talk to people who live in the night, over those years, they probably know him better than the day people.
And then there's the day people who stay up all night listening to Bob and have to go to work and are really tired, too.
Right. Who are addicted to Bob's show.
Addicted to Bob's show. I mean, for example, there's one listener who talks about in the 70s growing up on Staten Island and, you know, just staying up all night. She was a teenager, staying up all night and hearing about him protesting the war and hearing all this music, and nothing that anyone in her family, anyone of her peers at school had ever exposed her to. And this person is actually Bob's wife now. But
I knew that story was coming to the end. I was like, that sounds familiar.
Right.
There's a lot of listeners like that. I mean, people who have these very specific stories of when they first heard Bob. I mean, there's this one guy who just remembers he was doing some all-night security detail at some hospital or something like that, and he turned on the radio one night and he hears Sergeant Pepper's. He's like, oh, great. Then he hears the next song, and then he hears the next song. Then he hears the needle, the record flip over, and then he hears the next song. He's like, wow, he's playing the entire album. And then the album ends, and then there's a pause, and he starts playing the entire album again. And so it just... taking chances like that, it's completely free.
And I think that's the point of the historical aspect of Bob and what he's contributed to the medium of radio and broadcasting, really as an invention and a continuing experiment. As you know, that free form, it's still not formed after 50 some years. Yeah. I mean, we're still in that experimental stage, which is still innovative.
Right.
You know, even in today when we think all the creative ways to put something on the radio has already been done, it's still being sort of massaged with Bob. I think about a month ago, I was on Bob's show for the first time, and he came maybe 40 minutes late. So I was on the air with, I don't know, an engineer or something, but he was stuck on the bridge. So he couldn't get through traffic, so he finally came on. But, you know, that was just the way it is. You know, that's New York City for you.
Right. People we've spoke to about Bob, they talked about him as almost like a jazz musician, you know, and playing the beat and, you know, going from one flow to the other. And it's a total improv, freeform thing. But, you know, who could do that? I mean, it takes a real true artist to be able to think five steps ahead, and even if that's subconsciously, and, you know, just pulling random CDs. He has a bag of CDs that he brings with him every time, and videotapes, and, you know, records, and books that he'll read from, and callers that he, and it's just pulling things and putting it on the air and changing it and overlapping, and it's this amazing.
Can we just play a record in the meantime and go in there and just
yeah, any records you want to hear?
Oh yeah, I want to hear that Lightning Hopkins record.
I got a black cat bone, I got a mojo too, I got the John the Conqueror, I'm gonna mess with you.
In a compressed example of what freeform radio is, this next sequence taken from a 1976 air check, Bob Fass goes from taking a phone call about the unrest in Ireland to singer-songwriter and the guitarist of the Byrds, Roger McGuinn, jumping in about his near-miss from a bombing at LaGuardia Airport, then to a live music performance. This is a good example of freeform radio.
You're on the air.
I want to talk about Northern Ireland again.
Go ahead.
Okay. In 1921... there was still the Civil War going, the Black and Tan War. And the Black and Tans, they were called that way because these guys were taken right out of British jails. Some British film board, I think it was, suppressed a film about this guy named Michael Collins, who was an intelligent, in charge of the intelligence of the IRA at the time. And he knocked off a whole bunch of British spies and dudes like that. He was pretty, you know, he was embarrassing. He really made them look bad.
The Laughing Boy, they called him. Right?
Truth, I'm not all that hip on Irish history to know that.
Michael Collins.
Well,
right?
This guy from Wales made a movie about it, like a documentary to be shown on British TV or any TV, and they suppressed it.
I know a little bit about some of this because I was an actor, and I was in an off-Broadway show called The Hostage by Brendan Behan, and...
I don't know a whole lot about him either.
Oh, you should read Behan. You'd love him. You'd love him. You'd love him. He's so human and so warm and so crazy and so funny.
All right.
And he's beautiful. Just beautiful. Brendan Behan, The Hostage, was a great play about somebody who's on the verge of being executed in Glasshouse in Dublin. Mountjoy Prison, Mountjoy Prison in Dublin.
And they still got IRA guys in there.
And The Hostage is about a young British Army soldier is kidnapped by the IRA, and he's held in a whorehouse because, you know, that's the underground cover, and it's a great, great play. The bells of hell go ring-a-ling-a-ling for you, but not for me. Oh, death, where is thy sting-a-ling-a-ling? And the whole cast comes out, and they do a vaudeville turn, and it's just, like, great.
Well, you know, they got a play now with the, it's the Irish Arts Center. It's on 51st Street on the west side. It's called The Flats, and it's about Belfast and about a house on a corner where they have those riots. And they got a British soldier in there, too. There was an accident, like, on the road, it was in the middle of the town. And when the guy jumped out, he had left one of these guns in the car, and he left his identification, and he had the names of several Republicans, IRA people, and Sinn Féin people in the neighborhood, you know, who had been let out of prison or something. And he was going to go around knocking them off, you know, because he'd been keeping records of their data, and he had two weapons in the car, like automatic weapons, and he split out. You know, he got away. But by their, you know, the IDs and the stuff he left in the car, they figured he was a British agent. And they've been doing this, and there's British agents in New York City right now.
I came in through LaGuardia the night before last, and I was looking at the gray dust on the walls and the bowed out windows and doors.
Sick.
Yeah, crazy.
That was more than crazy. That was sick, man.
I know. Well, yeah, it was strange, you know.
I mean, it's no propaganda or nothing.
I know. Nobody claimed it, right?
You think it might have been some kind of an accident that was something that was bound for someplace else?
I would say it was for the place. They said it blew a 10 by 15 foot hole in a reinforced concrete ceiling.
They said it was a professional job. It didn't look like the kind of stuff that people got off a construction site or anything like that. It was.
Yeah, but isn't it possible that it was a package that was being, say, taken to Angola?
No, they found two other bombs in the same terminal area.
Really?
Were they planted or were they?
Did they find two other bombs?
That's what I heard.
Were they planted or were they just in other suitcases?
Oh, they were in suitcases, yeah.
Ah, so it still could have been like it was bound for someplace else, for some CIA
That's
toolkit,
possible, but I'm not sure. I shouldn't be saying this, because I'm not positive about the details.
Tonight?
Roger McGuinn is here. That's Roger McGuinn.
I came in from, I was up skiing in Minnesota, and believe it or not, they've got some skiing over there.
Weren't you in Vail, Colorado, in the president's party?
That's a 10-4 there, guy. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, we're. The CIA invited me over for, a brief skiing.
Brief.
Little vacation, little Christmas holiday vacation out there. No, I didn't go to Vail. The company, didn't support me. But no, I went to Minnesota and I came back on North Central Airlines. Not to plug anybody, but and the terminal I landed in was LaGuardia, which was between the TWA and Delta thing. And I had to walk down through the baggage claim area to get out of the airport. And there was all this gray powder around. It smelled like dynamite inside.
I was in the LaGuardia, and I went into a bookshop. And the book clerk was talking about what it was like at the moment of the impact and how the smoke filled the place. It must have been a...
I wasn't there for the blast, but I was there for the aftermath.
Glad you missed it, man.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
I missed it by about 72 hours, but some friends of mine missed it by about 25 minutes.
What kind of motions are you making out there that are distracting
you? I've seen motions to those women.
Listen, women are in total control of tonight.
Right, I see.
Right on. Oh, sister.
When I come into your
studio.
We have
six or eight women moved in advance of you guys.
Lee and Muffy.
Put all of the microphones together.
St. Robin? Who's St. Robin?
Forget about Slocum and McGuinn.
Right.
Well, forget it. That's what we say. Forget about them.
They're out there setting up. I mean, women are the engineers of the world.
Right.
So let's get it on.
La 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 la.
We have something to say about Leonard Crowdog. He's a Sioux Indian.
Leonard Crowdog is the Hurricane Carter of the Sioux Indian tribe.
Since Hurricane...
Worse than Hurricane Carter.
It'd be better if you talked into a microphone.
Yeah,
especially when you're saying such good things.
My sisters, I love you.
You were...
Lola gets a little effusive sometimes.
You're listening to the lunatic fringe of the feminist movement.
We are the feminist movement.
Yeah, the lunatic fringe.
When I was a little girl, I wished I was a boy. I tagged along behind the gang.
One of the things, as we were talking about how he invented freeform radio, that really doesn't hit in terms of a specific for today's people. But if we can sort of think about old-time radio where everything's scripted and there's a live audience and you see, Judy Garland say something and Lana Turner says something else and there's Bob Hope as the host sponsored by Ovaltine or stuff like that, that's how radio was for the American people. But then Bob came in and this sort of idea of public radio and Pacifica Radio and WBI meant that there were no sponsors, there was nobody to live up to other than the listeners. So the idea of opening up the airwaves and letting people call in and just dialogue. Just talk at your own pace, say what you want. Nothing is edited, nothing's censored, nothing's mediated, except by Bob's subconscious, if you will. That was an absolutely mind-blowing thing for people who had been trained that you're waiting for the commercial, you're waiting for the script, you're waiting for the announcer, the narrator, and the introduction. Right. And this is sort of where it never fits that form. So that's what's so mind-blowing about Bob, for me anyway.
Yeah, and there's examples of where something like that can lead. I mean, he was extremely active. I mean, the Yippies, the Youth International Party, were announced on his program, and he was an early Yippie. And, you know, when they started doing all these be-ins and these very innovative protests in and around New York City, he would use that, the call-ins and the callers, you know, when there was a riot at Grand Central Station. And
this was 1969, right?
1967, I believe. I could be wrong there.
But in that period, smack dab.
Directly before Chicago. And
it led up to the riots that were happening in Grand Central were, you know, a window of what was going to happen in Chicago because the police were getting more active.
Late 67 into 68.
But callers, but his show, I mean, it was this exciting thing. It was after the BN in Central Park, you know, the first hour of the show, he's playing songs about trains and, you know, it's like a very happy, you know, it's all about love. And then, you know, things went awry and then protesters were getting arrested and beaten by the police, and he had people call in, and then it turned into this, you know, kids calling in, like, you know, a cop hit me over the head, what do I do? And Bob's putting them in touch with the ACLU, whoever it might be. He's just having people, witnesses who are there, talk about what they experienced. I mean, it's live radio in the most intense way. I mean, I listened to it 40 years later, and it's very powerful, and right. He's in the trenches.
We have someone here who saw some. Let me tell you this before we go any further, that there was something on the tape that said that the people who were arrested are being taken to the 17th precinct. That's about the only information that we have so far about where the people who have been arrested are being taken. So I'm trying very hard to find out where they are, and we have someone who called up before and said that they were in the police station in Grand Central Station. And there was someone who was injured, and that they couldn't get medical assistance for this person because they couldn't find the officer that made the arrest. I don't understand that. That they had been waiting for nearly an hour since this man had been injured. Hello, where are you now?
Oh no, I was at Grand Central Station before.
Yeah, do you want to tell us anything about what happened?
Yes. I was over there.
Yeah.
And I was dressed. Natural. And these cops up there were pushing me around, and I was just coming out from eating a frankfurter. And I wasn't even doing nothing.
What do you mean by natural?
You know, I was dressing, you know, regular clothes, collegiate. And
where do you go to school?
Me? I don't go to school.
You were just dressed in collegiate style.
I was.
Maybe they got you for impersonating a student.
Nah, I wasn't dressed like you know, the hippies.
What were you doing there?
Nah, you know, me and my friend, we just went down there because, you know, they said that there was, you know, this big thing going on down there, and
Hello?
I'm on this line.
Oh.
Okay, can you tell me what happened?
You know, we just, you know, got off the train, and we went upstairs, everything was going nice. At the beginning, there wasn't no trouble.
Yeah?
But then after a while, that's when everything started.
What kind of trouble was that?
You know, the cops started pushing everybody and chasing them all the way to the back. You know, and everybody was knocking down each other. And then, you know, when I was coming out from the needle stand, the cop up there, pushed me with the stick.
Yeah.
And my friend, too.
Had you done anything?
I didn't do nothing. I was just walking to catch the train to come home.
Could you see any reason why people were being pushed around?
I didn't see no reason at all, because they weren't bothering nobody.
Okay, if you hear about this thing ever coming to trial, I hope you'll come forward and say what you saw.
Okay. I would like to know if you play any records.
Over there in South Vietnam, our boys are fighting rain. Some mother dear is praying.
you know, he kind of takes this cue himself from Gene Shepherd and, you know, wondering who's out there, how many people are out there listening. And, a famous example of that is the Film Network. And they, you know, I'm not going to take it anymore. And they, you know, the people yell, stick their heads out the window. So, which was based on something that Gene Shepherd did. And, you know, and Bob, after midnight, there's no ratings. You don't know how many people are out there. You don't know who's listening. But before all this, before Grand Central, before the BN, he wanted to know himself. He referred to his listeners as the Cabal, which, you know, roughly means, you know, people meeting in secret at night on horseback or something like that. And he just felt it was a good term to describe the night people. So he just said, let's have a party. Let's go out to JFK in one of the airport hangars and see how many people we could get. And thousands of people showed up.
Wow.
And
what year was that?
That was 66.
Well, one of the things is when you look at the folios, you go down the list and it has, you know, the 6 o'clock program, you know, Sonny Rollins in the studio, the 8 o'clock program, Allen Ginsberg in the studio. Anytime Bob shows listed, there's just the name of the show, Radio Nameable, because he doesn't know who's going to drop in. So some of the things that happened over the years, one of Bob Dylan's very, very first radio appearances was on his program, and they basically just did comedy. And then he also had Bob Dylan coming by other times after that playing music, and you know, Jerry Jeff Walker, for the very first time in public on live radio, performed Mr. Bojangles. The very first version of Alice's Restaurant was performed on Bob's show.
Right.
He was in the trenches in Chicago at the Democratic Convention in 68, walking around the streets during the protests, like getting hit, you know, sprayed with tear gas while recording reactions from people, you know, in the war zone. And you know, all of that's in the archive.
You know, during the Chicago 7 trial, Abbie Hoffman called Radio Nameable every night to report what was going on in the trial. That's amazing.
And then when Abbie Hoffman was in hiding, too, after he got arrested in the early 70s, and Bob's show was kind of his lifeline to the rest of the world. I mean, very few people knew where he was, and Bob was one of them, and he called into the program. And but then there's just all these, you know, people who are either starting out or happen to be in town that might stop by. You know, everyone from Muddy Waters and Allen Ginsberg and Patti Smith.
The thing about Bob, and I think this is similar to a lot of people of his generation and maybe just similar to people in general, is that Bob's a pack rat. He doesn't like throwing things out. He wants to keep everything. And for an archivist, that's, you know, a dream. It's a golden, wonderful egg to have. You don't like people who throw things out every, you know. But as a person living in a small house with minimal funds to put those things somewhere where it's not in their daily life, it's very difficult for him. So unfortunately, he and his wife live amongst this history. And because it's in their daily routine, they're not taking care of it properly the way they need to do. They need, you know, to get from one end of the house to the other, they need to move 500 reels. And to, you know, they're not thinking the long term. They're thinking, I need to go to the bathroom. I need to go to the kitchen. And so it's a matter of, you know, one, trying to preserve these things, but two, trying to give them a living environment.
You know, I think our listeners, at least some of them, might understand what that process is. If you think about it, your grandmother's garage that hadn't been taken care of, the old attic that hasn't been taken care of, and you just don't think about it, and, you know, 40 years go by, and you're looking for the photograph that it's now brown or yellow. And that's what we're talking about. These are absolutely, you know, carbon-based materials that do deteriorate much faster than we think, and the tapes are not being held and preserved properly or boxed properly. And so we have sort of a dream to rescue those tapes.
You have been listening to Bob Fass and his Radio Unnameable program on From the Vault, the Pacifica Radio Archives program that takes our history out of the vault and onto the radio. We'd like to thank Paul Lovelace and Jessica Wolfson for their efforts to save the Radio Unnameable recordings, and special thanks to Lynn Fass and Bob Fass. For more information or for a copy of this program, call us at 1-800-735-0230 or visit FromTheVaultRadio.org. From the Vault was written and produced by Brian DeShazer and Mark Torres, and executive produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives and Brian DeShazer. From the Vault is presented as part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, which is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts and grants from the Grammy Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the University of California Berkeley's Moffitt Library, the Pacifica Foundation, and from contributions from Pacifica station listeners. Our theme music is by Kevin Drum Holiday. Thanks for listening.
Good afternoon. You're tuned to 99.5 FM WBAI in New York. This Bob Fast tribute came to you on recording over listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio WBAI in New York. Coming up at 12:30 is On Contact with Chris Hedges. Stay tuned.
Hey, Harry, old buddy, old pal.
So I want you to be my buddy.
Why can't we be friends?
You've got a friend.
Friend. Good.
Friends or buddies, as we like to refer to you as here at WBAI. Either way, we invite you to join us and become a member of this fine radio station. We want to partner with you, but we want to do it in the least imposing and most painless way possible. Here's the deal. It's called the Buddy Pledge. You give us your support for 12 months, and we give you access to the most eclectic music, as well as the best and thought-provoking news, talk, and community affairs. Sound good? See it in your heart to pledge a minimum of $10 per month. Each payment will automatically be deducted from your credit or bank statement, so there's no reminders needed. Just join us for a one-year membership and go online at www.give2wbai.org. That's give2wbai.org and be part of our vibrant community. WBAI New York.
Hi, this is Tony Roberts, and you're listening to WBAI in New York.